Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Happy Tuesday and welcome to another edition of Global Leader Radio, the show with a particular focus on those individuals and organizations who do an exceptional job of identifying, attracting, developing, and retaining high potential talent. So the purpose of our show is to engage in conversations that highlight our guests, educate our learning community, and add value to all who seek to optimize their leadership acumen. So we achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways to include resources, advice, and tips that have led to personal and professional success for our guests. And you'll find out during this show that our guests have a lot of great tips and resources and a lot of great advice as well. So today we introduce two giants in the area of leadership, especially here in Atlanta, and they both have impressive resumes and have had quite an impact on the dynamic of character and integrity in leadership, especially in one of the major companies I've been involved in many years ago. So with that overview, we welcome our guests, Lynn and Dr. Bob Turknet. So Bob Turknet is the CEO and co-founder of Turknet Leadership Group, an Atlanta-based consulting firm providing leadership and organization development services to companies in a variety of industries. He's an executive leadership coach and a licensed psychologist with over 28 years of consulting experience, right?
Right, that's correct.
Good stuff. So Dr. Turknet specializes in CEO consulting, executive team development, and individual development and coaching. And his unique approach to coaching blends the psychological expertise with a great practical, extensive business knowledge. So he's been featured in many national, regional, and local publications as both a writer and a conference speaker. And prior to co-founding the Turknet Leadership Group, Dr. Turknet was the co-founder of the Georgia Psychological Health Network and chief psychologist for the Georgia Regional Hospital System. So he received his undergrad degree in business from Jacksonville University and his doctorate in psychology from the University of Georgia. So Dr. Turknet is also a member of numerous professional organizations and very active in the community, and he devotes a portion of his time to pro bono work each year, correct?
Correct.
Fantastic. And so the lady to his immediate right and across from me is Carolyn Turknet, affectionately known as Lynn.
Yes.
And so Lynn is co-founder and president of the Turknet Leadership Group, and she has more than 15 years of experience in management and leadership consulting. The focus of her work is organization assessment and change, executive team development, which is near and dear to my heart, and leadership in turbulent times, which is typically when leadership should manifest, correct?
And it's most of the time now.
So Lynn is particularly interested in helping teams at all levels improve communication and working relationships, and in helping organizations maximize their intellectual capital and create cultures that support flexibility and initiative. So Ms. Turknet received her BS in mathematics and her MA in sociology with a special emphasis in organizational sociology from University of Georgia. So like Bob, Lynn is a member of numerous professional organizations and is very active in the community and is an elder in the Presbyterian Church. So again, first I want to thank you both for joining us and welcome to Global Leader Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. That's a great introduction. Thank you very much.
And so you know I definitely read everything I'm sent, right?
Do you ever?
Sure.
So how are both of you today? You doing well?
Doing great.
You look fantastic. So what led you to begin the Turknet Leadership Group?
Well, I'll kind of take that. Bob, as you said, is a licensed psychologist, and I have that organization sociology background. We'd been working together, and we'd both had a real interest in leadership. We'd been dabbling in this area. And to be honest, we met somebody in 1987 who was doing executive assessment and coaching on the West Coast. Nobody even used the word coaching. He didn't use the word coaching at the time. He called it executive counseling.
Interesting.
And we linked up with him in
Mid-80s.
In the 1987. Mm-hmm. Bob went to visit him. He tells a story that he said his software was sort of...
Jackleg software.
Difficult to use. You don't want to have this. You probably can't make it work. We did our best, and it's been... That was the beginning.
It's been a great ride.
Been a great ride, yes.
Well, you know, you both juggle a lot of different roles. So husband and wife, parents, entrepreneurs, community servants, authors, researchers, leaders in your chosen field. Did I miss anything?
Pretty comprehensive there. Makes me a little tired.
Yeah. And I can tell you, when you do have that many roles, a few balls drop.
Yeah.
I like Betty Siegel's little story, though. I guess a lot of people, you juggle the balls and you try not to let the glass ones drop.
So that brings up a question. What tips can you provide all of us on how to make this kind of stuff work when you're juggling all those balls? What kind of tips can you provide us that can help us to really get better in that area? Because we certainly want to be more like the both of you.
All right. Well, we had someone speak to us recently who said that she doesn't work on balancing her life. She works on integrating her life, and that whatever she's doing, she tries to give 100% attention to it. And to me, that's the only way you make that kind of juggling work. It's never perfect, but if you're always thinking about what you haven't done or how you're failing in some area, somebody said worrying is praying for the worst to happen. And if you spend your life worrying, you don't get things done. I think for us, it's a matter of trying to stay realistic but positive and focusing on the things that have to be done at the moment, constant prioritization and constant real focus on what you're doing right at the moment, whether it's family, work, whatever it is.
And now that's just the two of us. We have more time to do a lot of the different things. But when our children were growing up, they were a priority. We made sure that our life was balanced in a way that we were able to spend the kind of time with them that we wanted to. So we set up our business and set up our life in a way to make sure that happened. So and we were able to do that, which we were very fortunate because not everybody is.
Makes sense. So, you know, certainly you have a lot to do with leadership. And when I think of leadership, I always think of the TurkNet leadership group. But how does the TurkNet, the founders of TurkNet, and the two principals, how do you define leadership?
Well, Robert Galvin says leadership's about going first and being followed. And I think that's when we first started writing this book, Decent People, Decent Company, we... had titled it Going First, Quit Waiting for Leadership. And then we read that what Robert Galvin had said, and so I think that's one way we define it is being able to go first and to really see the accountability and responsibility, but also in terms of our model, the respect and that strong base of integrity that we talk about a lot in our book.
We also say that leadership is not something that is only a quality of people who have position power. Mm-hmm. We believe strongly that leadership is something that has to develop in an organization. It has to be a part of an organization, but everybody plays a role. And that's so much more true now, even, I think, than in the past. We are excited to create situations where people recognize their leadership, recognize that they are leaders in multiple roles. I think all of us know that we're leading in our family, but we don't often recognize that we're leading in our church, that we're leading in our community, that we're leading in the school that our kids are attending, and that we have a role in the leadership of whatever organization we're working with.
Great point. I do know that John Maxwell talks a lot about leadership, and one of his definitions that I always paraphrase is that, you know you're a leader when you can look behind and see someone following you.
That's exactly the Galvin point.
And if you turn around and nobody's following you, his favorite saying is that you're merely taking a walk.
Right.
But in keeping with that, you also were talking earlier before we were on air about some research you're doing with coaches of different sports. And as you do that, obviously you'll find so many different leadership styles, which all can be effective and all can work, but there are certain behaviors and characteristics and traits that are important in terms of how they go about implementing their style. And there are things that people can work on and change and get better at, but they don't have to change their style. They don't have to do it the way somebody else does it.
That's very interesting, because I actually have a couple of questions around that, and I guess I'll skip to one of them. Are leaders made or are leaders born?
Well, obviously we believe that leaders are made. Probably there's some heredity that has a bearing for sure, but in terms of the business we're in, we probably wouldn't be in this business if we didn't believe that leaders are made.
There's got to be some hope in there somewhere for guys like me, right?
No matter who we're working with, we're always working on growth, and we all are a work in process, so
That's
we all
right.
have plenty of room for growth, right?
Good point. Lynn, what do you think?
Well, I would agree. I think there's an element of both, no question about that. You probably know, there's a lot of data on that. There's a lot of research that extroversion for many people is an important part of leadership in many cases, in many situations, not for every situation, but in some. And a lot of that is genetic. We know that.
Correct.
But we have seen over the years, one of the joys of what we're doing is see so many people who didn't think that they could be successful leaders learn to be successful leaders. I got to tell you one thing. Somebody told us, we were at a party last night, and somebody who's in search came up to Bob. And
executive
said,
search.
Executive search. You don't know this, but I lost a job because of you.
That's humbling.
There was a CEO that was being referred to me, or a placement, a job, and they decided to refer the current CEO to you, talking to Bob, and you fixed him. He didn't tell us who.
Well, with that, you're the perfect segue. So tell us a little bit about the TurkNet Leadership Group and exactly what you guys and ladies certainly do there. And a little, you can certainly brag on your organization as well and your players there back at the office.
Right. We do so many different things that often we start off with a different answer to this question, right? So you want to...
Well, I'd say our sort of claim to fame over the years, obviously, has been leadership development with a strong focus on executive assessment and coaching. We have always, though, done a lot of work in organization assessment, in cultural assessment and change, and part of the reason for that is our strong belief that leaders are the ones who shape the culture, set the culture. So we do a lot of work in that arena. And as a sort of paradox to that, we also believe that every single person in the organization has an impact on the culture. But we are also now, we have some wonderful industrial organization PhDs and PhDs in waiting at our organization. And they do wonderful work in competency modeling. We do a lot of executive selection work, a lot of selection work at other levels, a lot of work in performance management systems, and especially in integrating and aligning HR systems within organizations. Because we feel like if you're going to create a culture that's all moving in one direction, everything has to sync. The competency model, the performance management system, the 360 that you're using, the career development path, the job descriptions, how you hire, everything has to be in alignment. And they are fabulous at that.
And we're probably best known for working with the top team or teams in the organization, because that's what we did for so many years. But as Lynn says, adding the PhDOs, psychologists, and all that they bring in terms of helping to integrate the HR systems with the vision and mission of the organization gives us the ability to help a company more full service now. So we really enjoyed that.
Well, you know, in about a minute, you covered a breadth of things that probably has gotten, it's probably taken you, 15, 20 years to perfect and get it to the way you really want to have it all added in.
No question about that. No question.
Yeah, so I wanted to give you a little bit. I want to break it down a little bit more and probably unpack a few things. So, for example, I am a person who wants to come to you, or an organization that wants to come to you. What does your best client or an ideal client look like, customer-wise, company-wise, individual-wise? You work with individuals, I would imagine, as well as companies.
Mm-hmm. Although most of the time, I'd say – 98% of our work over the years has been for a company. It may be an individual who's coming to us, but it's through the organization.
So it's B2B. Your customer is the business.
The customer is always essentially the business. That's always an interesting question to answer because we have worked with companies from the Bell South of the world, and we've got a lot of those clients now, to very relatively small companies, often referred by a VC. Mm-hmm. I'd say our client that we do the biggest, the sort of full range of services for, are companies that are about, say, 50 million to a billion. And those are companies that often don't have huge internal HR systems. Okay. So they're needing help with, you know, how do we organize this? How do we hire? How do we think about hiring? Often people come to us, especially, at many stages of growth when they're thinking about succession. And that's getting nearer and dearer to our heart now as we think about it personally.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But succession planning, good succession management requires you to have everything in your organization right. You have to have strong top teams. You have to have good talent coming in. You have to be developing that talent. You have to have good ways of measuring how they're progressing, figuring out what the gaps are. All the things that we do, succession takes that.
Understood.
Makes that happen.
And you also have to understand the generational differences because, as we know, there are four generations in the workplace today, right?
Right. Okay. Yes.
Interesting. So now you mentioned something a little earlier I wanted to piggyback on. You mentioned a little bit about the paradox of leadership. Mm-hmm. So can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I think what I was talking about then is we feel like top leaders are 100% responsible for creating a workplace where people are engaged, where people want to stay, and where people feel like they're going to give every bit of a discretionary effort they can. However, we also feel like that every person in the organization is 100% responsible for creating a successful organization. They are responsible for leading and for doing what they can to make that organization successful just as much as the top person. That's kind of a paradox, but when you can get an organization where everybody feels like that and everybody recognizes their own power and their own responsibility, you've got not just a successful place, but a great place for people to work.
So why do you say it's a paradox, Bob? Why is that such a paradox?
Well, because a lot of people think that the leadership of the organization is up to the top team. That's the top team's job. That's the top team's responsibility. And then when that's the case and people view it that way, what you hear from below that are people who are complaining and feeling like the top team's not measuring up, they're not doing what they should be doing, et cetera. So when we would go into companies, we would just hear that over and over again. So it's in their best interest. It's in everyone's best interest to view themselves as 100% responsible, no matter whether you're in top team or not. Not just for your job or the way you view your job, but for the total success of the organization. So if there are mistakes being made or errors, then you or I have a responsibility to do whatever we can and to keep focusing on that. And even if we're unsuccessful, that would be our focus as opposed to sort of shaking our hands and saying nothing we can do about it.
Very interesting. It's amazing. I'm going to continue to refer to your book called Decent People and Decent Company. It was, I think the first printing was out in 2005, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, how to lead with character at work and in life. And specifically on page 3 in the introduction, I found this so intriguing. I actually had to highlight it years ago. And to your point about a paradox, it says, if you don't think you're contributing anything of value to the company you work for,
right,
and you can't figure out how to do so, then why are you accepting a paycheck?
Right.
And I just wrote a three-letter word right here. I just had wow with two exclamation points next to it. It says, do something provocative or move on.
Right.
And so anyone can sit on a bench and complain, but no one deserves to be paid for it.
Right.
That's some powerful stuff.
Right. And also, it doesn't help the individual. It doesn't help me just to sit back and complain. So I can get in the habit of that very easily, and we're all wired in ways that make that easy for us to do. So we have to really work hard to make sure we don't get into that mode. And you can see it everywhere, you know, in politics or wherever. So it's very much reinforced in our culture. So to go against the grain and to really view yourself as 100% accountable, 100% responsible is the best way, but we're not always able to see that.
Interesting. Very interesting. So another thing I noticed when I was looking at your website, doing a little bit of research for this program today, is that you're starting to do, I say starting because I'm just looking at it mm-hmm. A few days ago, but you're doing more around the gender side of leadership. So what gender differences do you see in leadership?
We've done quite a bit of research, and we have a lot of data, as we said, so we've done quite a bit of research with men and women in terms of the different leadership styles, but you might want to speak to some of that, Lynn, terms of some specifics we've done.
And interestingly, this is the 10th year of our Women in Leadership seminar series, started by Susan Hitchcock, who is also an ex-Bell Souther from...
Yes.
She took retirement in 91 and has been with us for 20 years, but she's the... She's the mother of women in leadership. But it's speaking to...
I love that. Is that a tagline that we're going to
develop
now?
That's a tagline. Yes, right.
But I was going to say for our company, but maybe for period.
Right. But she's... anyway, we've done 360 research looking at the differences. And the first time we did that was probably about 12 or 13 years ago. At that time, we had about 47 dimensions, I think, on our 360. Interesting. We discovered that women at that time were scoring significantly higher than men on about 22 of those dimensions, and only one were they scoring lower.
And that was
self-confidence.
Interesting.
And, you see that. That's I'm not sure why. Obviously, that's a perception. But we do know things like the book... Oh, goodness, I'm blanking her name. The woman who wrote, Linda Babcock, who wrote Women Don't Ask, and looking at the difference in how men and women negotiate for their first salary. Mm-hmm. Basically, what happens is men do negotiate when they get an offer, and women just say, thank you very much. And that makes about $400,000 difference over their lifetime.
Wow.
And that kind of, that hampers women. It also shows up in leadership when they get offered a promotion. Men often say, sure, I can do that. I'll take that job. Women sometimes say to themselves and sometimes to the person who's asking them, do you think I'm ready for that?
Hmm.
And those kinds of things impact women's ability to take risk and often their ability to get to the top. Now, I'm not saying that it's women who are the only reason why they're underrepresented in top positions. I think we've got a system, obviously a culture in our organizations that...
Perhaps not as supportive as it should be.
Not as supportive as it should be of anybody who doesn't look like the typical CEO of 30 years ago.
Understood.
And consequently, also, we've over the years we've been doing what we're doing, have seen a real shift in a lot of women moving into the entrepreneurial or to small businesses where they have more opportunity and are able to sort of use their skills and so forth. So it's been a big shift in that direction, I would say.
More opportunity, probably, and more flexibility
right.
in terms of their
lifestyle.
So they can really create what they need to so that they can be at their best most of the time.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What's very interesting to me and was always great for me coming up through the Bell South ranks and hearing about the TurkNet and the TurkNet Leadership Awards is probably where I first heard of it, the Leadership Awards piece of it. And then what you need to do to prepare and make sure that you're successful enough as an organization from the bottom up so that you can then even qualify for any type of awards. To be award ready was a big deal for us in the Bell South days. But now getting a chance to actually meet you and sit down across from you and having read your books and kind of taking the past and bringing it to where I am today, your stuff is research-based. It's not just some anecdotal thing that you're thinking that women should be more represented in certain areas. I mean, you have gotten the proof from a large incise that says, you know, these women are scoring high on and are in a par with men, except for this one aspect, and this one aspect is what we're going to now design our leadership women's leadership conferences around. Correct?
Yes. Yes. How do you help women address that perception? And if it's more than a perception, address their own confidence.
So what are the leadership conferences telling you based on what you're learning from the people who have come to these different conferences? I would imagine that it's 99.99% women, but there may be a man or two in there somewhere, right?
When we do our women in leadership work, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. what are we learning?
Yes.
That's such a broad guide.
Well, we only have 45 minutes, so... But give us your highlights or your thoughts, the first things that come to mind. And especially those things that our learning community can really take as advice and things they can work on.
Right. You know, I think one of the things about confidence that gets said over and over again, and Bob has always said this, is that it's there for the taking. And the part of confidence is deciding you're that person and being that person. One of the things we also know more and more from neuroscience, from what's happening out there, is that when you behave, when your body language says you're confident, you feel more confident inside. Hmm. I love the book, I think it's The Secret Language of Leadership. And I've used this example with women. He says we should use the example of the dog whisperer as an example of leadership presence, Cesar Millan.
Right.
He has a sense of presence when you look at him, when you just watch him. And basically, he's teaching the people that he's working with to do the same thing, to develop that sense of presence. As a woman, I really had to do that early on when we were working with leadership teams. Hmm. I mean, 20 years ago, when Bob and I started doing that, they were almost all men. And I could have been easily intimidated. I was sometimes intimidated. But I found that if I planted my feet, if I looked people in the eye, I never had great posture, but if I stood up as tall as I could, that...
But she never had any problem doing that with me.
No.
Ever.
Good practice, right, Bob?
Right.
Good, yes. That it made a huge difference. And we work in our work with women to help their confidence, to address that feeling of confidence in many ways. I think for one of the things that's the most powerful when people come to our Women in Leadership seminars, I think, is hearing the story of other women. Hmm. We learn, I think, so much from the stories of other people, how they've done it, how they've made it, how they've made it work in their life, how they've developed their own confidence, their own strategic sense. I think that's another place that women often get dinged. I think the other thing that has really helped many women who've come to those series is learning to manage stress. It's not just managing priorities, but managing stress. And we had a fabulous speaker, Lisa King, was maybe our last speaker or one of our last speakers. And she focused a lot on how much stress is sort of self-induced.
Okay.
That what a great quote from her, I hope I can do it, is, "Life is often really hard. With a little work, we can make it really unbearable."
So does the stress really come from this tired, worn-out acronym, FEAR, which is false evidence appearing real? Mm-hmm. So we're really making the world out to be something that it really isn't?
Well, one of the qualities in our leadership character model, which is a set of scales, if you picture a set of scales with the base integrity and respect on one side and responsibility on the other side, on the respect side of the scale, emotional mastery is one of those qualities, and that is a really important quality in terms of a person moving to higher levels of leadership. And that's where the stress and the way I handle or react to stress would be talked about or discussed, because it's my thinking that really creates my feelings. Mm-hmm. So that if I think in ways that are catastrophic and exaggerations, which we often do very easily, again, we're wired in ways to do that, then I'm going to be feeling in those ways. Whereas if I retrain my brain or retrain my brain to still be realistic but to not do that catastrophic thinking, then I'm much more calm, in control, and able to move with things even under very, very stressful situations. And no matter how stressful, that's still my best option, to train my brain to be able to do that. So that's a major part, probably a major goal in terms of women, but I think it's a major goal in terms of men also, because I've worked for years and years helping everybody with that particular quality, because it is so hard. And it's, you know, I'm a work in process. Lynn's work, we're all a work in process on that one. So it's something we have to keep on working on all of our life, because we're wired in ways that make it easy for us to react or overreact to things. And we don't have to do that, but we're sort of programmed, or make it easy for ourselves to be programmed to do that. So we have to keep working on that one.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar with something I've read recently, which talks about the fact that we were wired to be either fight or flight,
right,
way back in the caveman days.
Right.
And somehow we've replaced the fight or flight with some of the stress and worrying aspects of it, when they're really there's not a woolly mammoth running behind us anymore.
Right.
Except in our dreams.
Exactly. And then it gets a life of its own, and then all of a sudden we feel like that's reality and that's just the way it is, and I've got to live with that, and not realizing that we've done it to ourselves or continuing to keep doing it to ourselves.
So how do we practice, and how do we actually get ourselves to the point where we can somehow get better in the emotional mastery piece of it? Because you have actually said that it's one of the most important on that side of the equation with regard to your leadership model. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a split second. But since you've already gone there, and emotional mastery is something I really am focused on, how can I get better?
Yeah. Well, you know, it reminds me of a story when our son, Rob, who was I think 4 years old, we were in Kentucky. I was working as a psychologist there in a hospital setting, and he wanted to do therapy like his dad. So, and that's as I was doing therapy, he wanted to do therapy like his dad. So I got the music therapist to pretend to be a patient. And so I had him come to work one day, and I had taught him this framework we're talking about now in terms of the emotional mastery frame. I had taught him that in terms he could understand. So I told him he could use those ideas and help her. So he goes in, and I'm watching outside the window. He goes in, and she's sitting there, and he sits in my chair. And so he asks her to tell him his problem, and she does. And then she says, when I'm in a group of people, I start laughing uncontrollably, and I just can't compose myself. And I'm just so embarrassed. I just feel so, so embarrassed, and I don't know what to do. And he said, first of all, just tell yourself that it's not terrible, horrible, or awful. And then, after you've calmed yourself, say, please excuse me, get up and leave, and then when you've gotten control of yourself again, come back into the room and sit down. And I thought, oh my gosh, so the idea is simple. It's really the terrible, horrible, or awful that we're doing to ourselves all the time that we don't realize, and we just have to talk to ourselves in a different way, that it's not terrible, horrible, or awful, but it's inconvenient, it's unfortunate, it's too bad. So what can I do about it? So that we use our brain to forward in doing what we can about it, because we're going to do that anyway. We always have to move toward that.
Correct.
So why do we want to spend all this time just sort of stewing in our juices? The only reason we do it is because it's like smoking cigarettes and getting cancer. We just do it because we don't realize how bad it is for us. So if we can see it a different way and start working on that, it's amazing how fast somebody can reframe that and begin to then sort of transform their life almost.
Well, it's interesting you use the words transform your life, because I'm a Tony Robbins devotee as well, and he calls it transformational vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you just said is basically what he refers to as transformational vocabulary. No doubt he got it from you. No doubt about that. So
you're talking about age now.
I'm talking about expertise. I'm talking about expertise and wisdom. So is it, this is something that you continually can work on, and the transformational vocabulary actually works?
And I actually, for sure, work on it every day of my life, and I'd say Lynn does too, and I bet you most people who we've talked with who, you know, and people do anyway. You are too. Everybody works on it. May not use the same terms and framework, mm-hmm, in terms of the way I've discussed it, but we're all doing that. It's just in those areas where we're still needlessly upsetting ourselves and making ourselves get angry and furious and all that, whatever those negative emotions are that are extreme, it's an area we're not working on. We're not we're not seeing that. And a lot of times I'm working with an individual, and he or she'll say, you know, but let me tell you what, this is different. And all of a sudden now they start telling me a story where they went off, you know, on the deep end emotionally.
Here's why I had to do that.
And it was really no different than any other, but they don't see it that way. So they see there's sometimes so it's that control is still outside them, and they got to realize the control is in here.
It's inside you.
Right.
Okay, interesting. So that brings up another saying that I've heard over the years. It is, why do we continually compare the worst in ourselves with the best in others? Mm-hmm. A little bit different spin, perhaps. But certainly the take is still there. We're still devaluing what we do and what we bring to the table, or looking at ourselves as being at a deficit to what's out there and what's against us. So interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. So what's most important for successful leaders in your opinions?
Wow. So many things, right?
Can we start with what we think is the... You know, we talk about character and leadership because we believe that's what's most important and what is really foundational. And we quote often Heraclitus, who said, character is destiny. And a friend of ours, Carl Kunert, who's a professor at the University of Georgia, has added, personality is not destiny.
Interesting.
We believe that character is what makes a leader worth following, and it's what makes people willing to follow that leader. It's interesting. You know, we've done a lot of coaching over the years.
Absolutely.
And the thing that the idea of character has been powerful for us in another way, too, because as you might imagine, people, when they come to us at about 40 or 50, they often think, I'm really cooked. I'm done. I'm not changing. I'm sort of who I am. And it does help to say to that person, your personality may have been formed when you're in your 20s. You're probably right about that. But your character is the foundation of your leadership, and your character is something you ought to be working on every day of your life. And almost everybody buys that when they think about it.
So they get that piece
they
of it.
They get that. They get that.
That's important. So if we flip the coin over, in your opinion, what derails most leaders?
Well, the probably most research studies would, especially in the past, would show that arrogance is the number one derailer. And the reason for that is that if I'm arrogant, then I'm not probably getting the input from my people. I'm not being open. I'm not listening. I'm not taking in what I need to be taking in. And we live in a culture now, business culture now, a culture at large now, that it's so complex that we have to sort of use the brains of everybody and value everybody. And if we don't do that, if we're arrogant and we don't do that, then we won't succeed very long. We might can succeed in the short term, but the person will not succeed very long. So if I'm wired in a way that makes it easy for me to do that, or if I've grown up in a way that makes it easy for me to do that, I've got to unlearn and relearn, because that's deadly. I'd say in today's time, also another one that comes right very close to it is agility or flexibility. That ability to be agile and flexible is so critical nowadays. And people who don't make it in organizations very long, that's usually in there. That's usually part of the issue for them, is they don't have that agility or that flexibility. They've got to see the world or have the world be a certain way. And we live in too complex a world for that to be the case now. So I'd say those are two major areas that derail.
And another one I think that's shown up in research repeatedly is the inability to make decisions, in a really timely manner, to be willing to go with 80% of the data that you almost have to be willing to do always, that people who can't do that finally derail. There's just not room for that.
Well, can you comment on another dimension, and I'm not certain if it's come up in your research, but certainly the one I hear and have heard a lot over my career is tolerance for ambiguity. That ability for a leader to, again, to your point, make decisions with only 80% of the information or data, being able to understand the arrogance that it exists within his or her organization and how they can eradicate that. Can you talk a little bit about that piece of it?
And you mentioned paradoxes earlier, and then being able to manage those paradoxes. I remember saying to my two sons, it's very important to take life seriously, And it's very important to not take life seriously. And while those two seem a contradiction, if I keep that in my head all the time, then I'm going to be able to do the things I need to do, but I'm not going to do myself in when I fail or don't succeed or make mistakes or do things that don't help me with my goals. Rather, I'm going to go back to the problem solving and do what I can to. So that's a paradox, but it's a helpful paradox. And I think that if I'm comfortable with ambiguity, then I'm also comfortable with those kind of paradoxes. I'm much more able to be flexible, agile, and move with things, and it's still making decisions in the right way, but not stuck in a certain kind of mode that will just do me in if I don't look at it from another perspective.
And I would 100% agree with you. I think, as Bob said, the flexibility and agility is necessary part of that tolerance of ambiguity. And I think that's also very necessary for dealing with the kind of diverse global climate we're dealing with. You just can't be certain of yourself. You can't even really be certain of your values. You have to be true to your values. Goodness, I've lost her name, but a person from Coke, I'll remember it by the end of this, who spoke at our Women in Leadership, said she lived by this: strong values, lightly held.
Interesting.
That is an ambiguous statement in itself, but there's something about that that is really true. We're living in a world where we have to accept, get along with, work with people who are quite different from us, quite different from the way we grew up, people who have values that are different from us. I remember a great situation I had. This is many years ago when I still had kids in school. I was the head of the health committee at our high school, and I had two people working for me in, you know, heading up the scub group of that committee, working on this big project. One of them was one of the strongest people in the state for Right to Life. The other, one of the strongest supporters of Planned Parenthood. And those two people were two women that I admired more than most other friends that I had. And I thought then, you know, darn, you know, who's right?
That's right.
But there was something about their willingness to work, their sense of responsibility for the community. There were things that we shared that were beyond those differences. And we all got to figure out how to do that, and it ain't easy.
So is that really what paradox is all about? It really is trying to understand where there are some polar opposites, and perhaps there's spaces along the continuum that we can actually focus in on and really get value out of, versus trying to call out one side or the other?
And being able to see the value of both sides.
Okay.
Yes.
That's what's so important also. I was thinking in terms of the tolerance of ambiguity and the flexibility. I remember working with I was called in to work with a company where the CEO had just hired a new president because he wanted somebody to be able to run the company because he had written a book and wanted to go on a tour and do some other things, but still manage the company but not as closely. And he brought in somebody who was much more like the, you know, very certain about ideas, very very much wanting things his way, and saw things in a much more sort of rigid framework. And I remember once I felt like I wasn't really getting anywhere with him, and then I remember once him coming in and he said, you know, all the things that you've been talking about and we were working on sort of came together today. He said, we had this contract with Disney Europe, and we are going to all have to take a hit and lose some money financially because we didn't bid it right. He said, ordinarily, this is what I would have done. I would have gone into the team, and I'd have said, look, we got a problem with Disney Europe, and you guys know what it is going to be, what the situation is. This is what we're going to do, and we're going to do it. I don't want to hear any bellyaching about it, and then I'd leave. He said, instead, I did it the way we talked about in here. And he said, I went in and I said, we've got a problem with Disney Europe, and I'd like to hear from each of you what you think, how you describe the problem, and what you think we should do. As they went around the room, each one did that, and he never had to say another word. They solved the problem, and they did have to take a hit, but much less than if he had just made that decision on his own. This guy was a very macho and very strong. He came out and he said, I felt tingly when I walked out of that meeting, seeing the power of being able to let flexibility and let other people do it. And he said, it's just amazing. So he said, I'll never go back to the old way again. And probably because of the way we're wired, he did to some extent, but he probably did make a major shift in his leadership from then on.
So is that old way what you call autocratic in the book?
That would have been that would have been autocratic and also rigid, much more in terms of he sees a certain person sees the world in a certain way, and it's got to be his way or that way. And we all go through some of that as we grow, and there's another model framework we use that has to do with adult development and the different stages we all go through. Mm-hmm. That if it, especially when we get to a certain level, we're pretty sure of what we know now, so we can get really sure of ourselves. And that's sort of where he was. For him to move to another level, he had to sort of open himself up again.
Correct.
To all possibilities and learn from everybody around him. And that was a major, you know, change for him.
Very good. So some people see character and leadership as synonymous with ethics. What do you two think?
Well, you know, we think it's a part of that, but a lot bigger than that.
Right.
Our leadership character model, as you know, and as Bob said, is thought of as a scale, set of scales, with integrity as the base, and a balance of respect on one side and responsibility on the other. And somebody said the other day that character seemed a little bit soft. And I said, you know, our view of character is not that it's soft. And I don't really think that most people think that. Most people think that somebody with character is somebody willing to stand up when it's hard to do, willing to follow through on their promises no matter what, willing to get things done even when it's hard. And we believe that that's character. That character is being absolutely know what your values are, be willing to live those values, be willing to share those values. That's integrity. It's also being willing to be kind to people, empathetic toward people, humble toward people, but it's also willing to be accountable, courageous, and strongly responsible.
So great. For those of you who are listening to our radio show today and those of you who are picking us up on the podcast, we will put the model up for you to be able to see. But as we're sitting here with the founders the creators of the model, the base of the leadership character model is integrity.
Right.
And again, you define integrity as?
As honesty, as authenticity, as knowing your values and being willing to live your values.
Okay, and so as I'm looking at the model face on the left side, there's respect, and then, of course, it's balanced with responsibility, and it is truly a scale in the model. Mm-hmm. And so define respect and then define responsibility. We're going to work our way right on up the model.
All right.
Well, respect is composed of four qualities: emotional mastery, humility, lack of blame, and
empathy.
And all of those interact and interrelate. So if I work on one, I'm going to make improvement on the other because they are closely connected, but they are also different. So it is and they're all very, very important. And then on the responsibility side is accountability, courage, self-confidence, and then focus on the whole, which has to do with the bigger picture and being able to see, like we were talking earlier about the person that was pretty rigid. One of the things he wasn't doing, and he prided himself on being a great business person and being able to focus on the bigger picture, and he did in many ways, but in this situation we were talking about, he wasn't focusing on, he wasn't looking at the bigger picture. He wasn't seeing what the consequences of his behavior and actions were on not getting the kind of results that he ordinarily would be able to get. So the focus on the whole is at the highest level of leadership, probably that's the most critical on that side, and at the highest level of leadership, humility is probably the most critical on the other side. They all still have to be strong,
right?
But those are probably the most critical on each side.
Most critical. And of course, humility is probably followed close second by emotional mastery.
Exactly, just because it takes that to be able to get past that level
for.
Exactly, exactly. And so it looks like when I look at these are all internal things, obviously, that we can work on and get better at as we move through, right?
Right, absolutely.
So you created the Leadership Character Model in 1995. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then you started the Leadership Awards in 2002, 7 years later, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first of all, how did you develop that model? I mean, how did it come to you? Was that something that, certainly was born out of your coaching and your work with corporations?
I would see people who, when I'm working with the individuals, in those days we would be working with the individual and the team, so I'd be doing a leadership development program that would go over a period of a year or two, mm-hmm. and individually, but Lynn and I would also be working with the team, or whomever else in our firm be working with the team. So when I was doing work with individuals, I would see these people who would say, leaders, CEOs, and others who would say that it's all about the bottom line and it's all about the hard stuff and I don't have time for the soft stuff. It's about results. It's about, performance results.
And that hasn't changed much now, has it?
I know. So they would say the respect side of the scale, and we didn't call it that then, was essentially that was for home or that was for church. In other words, they separated that from what they were doing in the business world. And so then we would also see people who were people that the people in the company liked and highly respected, but that person wasn't assertive enough. They didn't give them enough guidance, enough direction, because that person didn't want to be imposing. So I began to see sort of two opposites there. So that person would have been high on respect, but very low on the responsibility. The first example would be the person would be high on responsibility, but low on respect. So especially for the people who are high on the responsibility and low on respect, when we developed the model and they could see the picture, the pictorial, mm-hmm. it was amazing because they would be much more willing to think about that and make changes. They would always say things like, well, I'll lose my edge if I try to bring in some of this other, they would call it touchy-feely stuff. And then when they would get them to experience or practice it, they would see that not only did they not lose their edge, they were much more effective. They would come back and say, wow, these people would do anything for me now. And before, I felt like I was having to pull teeth to get them to do this or that or the other, and I was having to, whip them into shape. And so the whole way they were operating was getting the opposite of what they wanted, so they could see when they really balanced that responsibility and respect, it made a huge difference in what they wanted and what the results they got. And so that was the most effective for me because then I was able to help them really move forward faster. So that model was very helpful to us in being able to help people move more quickly and grow more quickly.
And I think the scale idea gave people the sense that they didn't have to give up something.
Right.
Those tough guys didn't have to give up their accountability. They just had to add something else. And that's the idea of balance. You keep both of them and you balance those two, which is a bit of a paradox in itself in everything that you do.
And it was so thoughtful to actually put it together in the form of a scale as a model, because if you take one of them off, it does tend to debalance the scale, mm-hmm. or cause the scale to be unbalanced, and then to add it. And sometimes you have too much of something that will cause a problem as well. And so that very interesting. I remember decomposing a lot of and having lots of these conversations in the old Bell South, and we got really deep, probably deeper than you imagined that we were <Yeah. laughs>
That's good to hear.
Very good. Yes.
But we thought we were doing something important, and it was great work, and it did show. Because certainly nobody wants to buy a company that doesn't have it all together, as it were.
Right. Yes.
So the awards have been, were they an offshoot of the work that you did? Or how did the awards come about?
Actually, the awards are thanks to companies like Enron and Help South, who, and thanks to Susan Hitchcock. Actually, in those years, which were kind of dark years, if you remember, it was after September 11th that we had Enron had failed shortly after that. We were hearing so much about corporations that had not done things in the right way, that had not lived by the values they espoused, had not treated people right. And Susan, actually, we came back from being out of town, and Susan Hitchcock and Suzanne Lavoie, who was with us at the time, said, "We have an idea. this is a tough time. Business is people are not thinking very highly of business folks right now. And we had all talked about the fact that most of the time, you know, most of the people we have seen in business are good, honest, decent people.
Right.
And we wanted to recognize those folks. And that was the beginning. We said, we'll figure out a way to do this. We'll figure out a way to use the model to help people figure out who ought to be nominated for an award, who we ought to lift up, and we'll just do that.
Well, good. The question that I want to ask, a couple of questions, and so around the awards, by doing these yearly awards, what are the outcomes you originally thought you'd see, if you thought you'd see an outcome, or was it just simply, I just want to recognize these companies for having done such a great job in this area?
I think originally it was to recognize the individuals and the companies who'd done a great job. We wanted to celebrate that because there was so much anti-business focus, and that wasn't even our experience. We really didn't have that experience. I mean, we were working with so many different companies, almost all the companies in Atlanta at one time or another, and other areas too. And we didn't have that experience. We were working with companies that were in the midst of really trying to grow their companies and do the right things. They might not always be doing the right things, but it wasn't because they were intentionally trying not to.
Okay.
So even though there was Enron and those things going on, that was not our experience. So we wanted to be able to hold that up in public in a different kind of way. So that was very important to us, to be able to sort of showcase what was going right in business. And I think, you know, it took off, and everybody just raves about it, and they beg us to not stop it because we're a small company to do this, and it's expensive and time-consuming, but it's worth it because people really do appreciate it, and I think it's very valuable for them. We're, in fact, thinking about trying to replicate it in other cities, maybe every city, if we possibly could figure out a way to leverage that and do that with the right kind of help and support. So there are many people who have told us they'd love to help us with that. So we're looking at that as a possibility also.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, when you think about how important it is for employees and colleagues and leadership to be lifelong learners, can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Absolutely essential.
Yes.
We
hope to promote that, and I think we live that. I think it's also a piece of character growth. There are a couple of points there. You have to be a lifelong learner in terms of everything's moving so fast now. Technology's moving so fast. Knowledge, we add so much knowledge every single day. All of us are... Any field you're in is completely different than it was 10 years ago. So you've got to continue to learn. You've got to love learning. And the Internet, our opportunities for learning now are just amazing. So it's an easy time to be a lifelong learner. But you've also got to be personally a lifelong learner, in terms of your character. And I think that's a big piece of what our life work is. And part of that is being constantly reflective and questioning. You talked about transforming your vocabulary or some, but part of it is thinking every day about how you're talking to yourself, how you're treating other people. Did you really follow through on your promises? Are you really thinking about this, whatever project you're working on, with every person and the entire goal in mind? Constantly questioning yourself in the most positive way, but constantly questioning yourself. You got to grow cognitively, and you got to grow character.
So in essence, what you're talking about really is around the contribution. If you're questioning the contribution you bring to the table, then certainly you're doing it in a positive fashion, right?
Oh, yes.
And so what's interesting about our program is that we're an executive MBA program, and recently, just a matter of fact, a few days ago, Mandy Brooks and I, Mandy Brooks is the marketing person who handles all of our marketing for the Coase College of Business, and she's also the associate dean, assistant dean. And she and I were talking about what would be a catchphrase, executive MBA, some teaming leadership and coaching is what we really focus in on. And so after the conversation, she basically came up with the idea that we are the executives MBA. And so when we started thinking about what is an executive, it is the things that you really focus in on. It is that whole character, leadership character model. Because we actually put people in intact teams of 5, 6, or 7 people. They don't get a choice of the teams. We use a little bit of art and a little bit of science to get us to that place. We support those teams with executive coaches, both individual as well as teams. And this is the true meaning of teams. This is more like self-directed teams. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to switch teams between those 5 semesters. And actually on day one, your first team assignment is due to me, and it has been in the past, which is it's a team constitution, much like a team charter in project management, mm-hmm. where you have one vision. You take 6, 7, or 8 people, and they have to come up with one vision for the team, one mission, one set of operating guidelines, the values and the behaviors that support those operating guidelines and vision and mission. And there's even disciplinary process built into the constitution up to and perhaps even including recommendation for dismissal from the program. So all of the things you mentioned in the model, it occurred to me as we were talking, is what people go through to understand how to work in the self-directed team. Now, I know you're more of the team person, right, out of the two of you.
Right.
And so can you speak a little bit about what you've noticed? And first of all, have you noticed very many companies using teams such that they actually are making decisions, they have autonomy, they're self-empowered, and they actually give each other feedback and help each other to get better? Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing in corporations today?
Yeah, and Lynn will talk to this, but I just want to, a few years ago, we were brought into an organization where they had went back when self-directed teams were first, that concept first introduced, and we were brought into the organization because the top leaders had decided they were going to go to self-directed teams, and then they just said one day, now we're going to do it. So there was no training or preparation, and what you're talking about is training and preparation for
and
that.
Support.
And support. So that's – but go ahead, Lynn.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, I think teams have become so ubiquitous that we don't even recognize it.
You mean the term?
The term.
Yes.
I mean people are working constantly in teams. Often in it's one of the things, too, that makes everybody's leadership skill more important because
yes.
so many people are working in project teams – where you are leading today and following tomorrow.
Right.
I think it's great practice, too, what you're doing, getting them to start with a team charter. And that's a real added bonus when you have the disciplinary process there, too. But to start with, where are we going? What's our vision? What are our operating guidelines? What are our values? I think many organizations are doing more of that. We certainly think that's an important thing for teams to do. But teams now, everything seems to be done through teams.
Mm.
And there are challenges also of global teams. That's
yes.
one of the things we're being asked about. How do you help and support teams that have never met each other? That are working on other sides of the world that don't have the same language, that don't... Those are, you know, what we used to talk about 20 or 30 years ago in terms of team challenges are nothing to what...
compared to what's going on
what
today.
Doing now. But what you said there, too, when you're talking... That's a wonderful thing in the MBA program, to start with a team and then say, you can't change that
team.
That's
right.
Because when we're in a situation in a business setting, that's often the case. You've got people to work with, and by gosh, you have to figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm. So I realize you've heard many, many acceptance speeches for the TurkNet Leadership Awards. And over the many you've seen and heard, can you tell us which speeches stand out and for which reasons?
Well, we gave a special award to this person who had a huge influence on my life, Dr. Frances Kenny, and she was my humanities teacher. She's in her mid-90s now, and she's just as active as you or I, and maybe more so in many ways. But we gave her the Inspiration Award, Leadership Inspiration Award, because she was sort of the idea behind this framework, this whole everything we're doing in this area. And she had a huge impact on my life. And then when Lynn met her, she had a huge impact on and continues to have a huge impact on our life. So when she gave her speech, she talked a lot about humor and adding humor and fun in your life. And she's the person who really, very demanding and highly accountable. but she's got that balance. So it was all that she talked about in terms of balancing that humor and the accountability that was so special to me.
I remember something. I probably can't give it exactly right. We gave Frank Skinner this year the first Lifetime Achievement Award, and he said something like, and he's, you know, he's not a young guy. He's in his 80s probably now, and he's given tremendously to the community. But in receiving that award, he said something like how much he appreciated it and how much he was going to continue every day to do what he could to deserve it.
Right.
And, you know, that was a powerful thing for somebody like that. And I think the funniest thing, or one of the funniest things, was Tracy Garner this year, who has been nominated several times, who said she was proud to accept this, that she was the Susan Lucci of the Leadership Character Awards.
And Tracy has been intimately involved with our program on a number of levels. She's been a coach in our program.
Oh, she's wonderful.
And she supports a lot of the students and has supported a lot of students that came through our program. What you may not know is that our program has the distinction of having graduated over 600 employees, leadership, et cetera, of the BellSouth, Singular, BAPCO, and AT&T. It's,
right.
It's the only program that has graduated so many from one family of companies, and it's been remarkable. We're going into our 20th year next year of our executive MBA program, and we had a separate cohort at one point for the number of people we had coming through our program from the BellSouth family or from the South Central Bell, BellSouth, Southern Bell, et cetera. So that has been very important for us, and certainly people like Tracy really help us to continue to keep the word going. Mm-hmm. And also making sure that people that are there are supported.
She's a fabulous leader.
She is.
Excellent.
She's a great mm-hmm. example of our model.
Yes, she is.
Wonderful example of our model.
So, and she's young, too.
That's
so,
right.
So in your mind, what does the future of leadership hold?
Oh, my gosh. We need you to answer that.
Talk about an ambiguous question, right?
I love it.
great things.
You know, we wrote an article in, like, I think it was maybe 1993 about how networking in organizations, the fact that organizations were networked and people could have access to information at any time, was going to change the nature of leadership, how we had to end post-heroic. It was the post-heroic leadership era. You couldn't be a heroic leader. Everybody had to lead. And, you know, I read the other day an article that was almost the same. They were talking about the internet, you know, like now everybody's connected to everything and we've got this, all this information, and it's the end of the heroic leader. And I thought, whoa. So, you know, I think we're just continuing to move further and further in that direction. We're also, the fact, as you said, that there are four generations in the workplace, we've got to really think about what does that mean? What's it mean for young people? How have the way they've been brought up make a difference in how they want to be led and how they want to participate in the organization? I love, you were going to ask us about a book. Daniel Pink's Drive is really good and really interesting, that everybody is looking for autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And I think that's, to me, that's important for the future in a lot of ways.
Good. Very good.
And I think our leadership character model, one of the reasons we developed it is because of how useful it was. But as we continue to use it and it continues to gain popularity, it's, you know, something that I think will be just as relevant 100 years from now or whatever, just because of the kind of it's not new. It's not, it's different in the way we put it together, but it's not new. It has to do with the kind of values and the kind of behaviors and ways we need to develop ourselves, who we got to become to be able to be the best leaders. I think that'll always be the case.
So how does it feel when you know that you've created something or been a part of being able to aggregate something? Because some people are possibly just a tad not comfortable with the thought that they've created something. They just say, okay, well, I've aggregated. I didn't create it. But how do you feel? I mean, how does that make you feel knowing that you've created something that will far outlive any of us? And it's a legacy type of contribution to society in to help organizations certainly to get better and individuals as well. I mean, that's a heck of a contribution.
Well, I feel humbled in terms of that because I don't really see it as a – I see it as an evolving kind of thing. So it wasn't something like came from genius. It just kind of evolved. And so it's nice that it evolved in the way it did and that it's able to be used in the way it looked at. But it's not something that I mean – anybody could have developed it, right?
Right.
Well, anybody could have, but only two people did. And so has it changed since you originally introduced it?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we first started it, we had accountability and lack of blame on the same side of the scales because people, when we go into companies and talk with people, they always, almost always mixed up accountability and blame. So they didn't see it. There was a difference there. So we, and then we started doing factor analysis, which is statistical, and then saw that actually lack of blame factored on the other side, on the respect side of the scale. So we moved it to the respect side, and then we, but the reason we, and we still talk about it is because people have a hard time in separating out blame from accountability, when in reality, blame gets in the way of accountability.
Blame. Okay, so can you define both?
Well, if you're trying to hold someone accountable, then and there may be consequences for behavior, that's one area. But to blame you for your behavior or your mistakes or what you're doing is going to cause you to experience feelings and reactions in a way that now takes your focus off of the problem itself and onto something else, and you go home and you talk to your wife or your children or whatever, and you're saying, I can't believe how they treat me. Whereas if you take the blame out of the picture and you focus on the issue and what we need to do so that it doesn't happen again, so that we make it better, so we improve it, then plus it's just the right thing to do. It's a respectful thing to do. But again, we're wired in ways that make it easy to blame, so it doesn't happen in that way unless we work at it. So that is, that's why it's so important to work on that.
So if I...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, when you hold somebody accountable or hold yourself accountable, if you look out the window, as we say, and you're looking for somebody to blame when there's been a problem, you aren't going to truly hold yourself accountable. I mean, we used to see that in organizations. Sales, we're terrific. If only marketing would get their stuff in shape. And that is looking out the window to blame instead of figuring out what can I do to solve this problem.
So one is more proactive and one creates more reactivity.
Absolutely. Right, absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. And more creates more negative consequences as a result of that reactivity. Right.
So what are the TurkNets doing to ensure they continue to grow and develop as leaders?
We read a lot. We go to a lot of workshops, conferences. We do many, many things to keep ourselves up to date as much as possible. People accuse Lynn of being the most avid reader of anybody. We've got every book you can think of in our office, and I do a lot, but she has been, and her mother was the same way. So I think we both do a lot to keep up and work hard at it. But there's so much knowledge now, and there's so much. You were talking earlier about lifelong learners. Gosh, it's so exciting. I mean, I can't imagine not wanting to be a lifelong. You know, it's so
correct.
Inspiring because you can keep learning and growing no matter what age you are. So to me, that's what's better than that, right?
Yeah, and I firmly believe you learn from everybody and you learn in every situation. You have to keep that attitude every day.
Yeah, well, you're exactly correct. So I could actually go on and talk to you for a long time. Again, this was a special treat for me. This is a holiday gift for me to have the TurkNets in. And certainly we've got about 2 million people listening to our program, so it was just 3 people having a nice conversation with 2 million people listening in. So now my final question for each of you, and we'll make your answer to this question available on our web posting. And as I am actually talking, I'm doing a little bit of filibustering so I can get to the video portion of this because I actually want to video your responses. So which book has most impacted your leadership ability? And we'll start with you, Lynn.
I could think of a lot of them, but I would say Good to Great, and I'm sure many people will say this, but Collins did a wonderful job to me of thinking about how a leader ought to think about their leadership and what they ought to aspire to. He said, as you might remember, that he found that level 5 leaders, as he described it, had 2 big characteristics. One was humility, and one was fierce resolve. And I think for me, those are 2 things that I constantly try to think about and try to balance. There are lots more. I talked about Daniel Pink and that new book, Drive. I have great respect for Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. That's one of those timeless books. There are many wonderful books, but I have a lot of respect for the way Collins made leadership and what you ought to do in an organization accessible. He's a great, great writer.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Wow. When we were writing this book, we had to, for the publisher, we had to say why what we were writing was better than five top books in this arena. And Good to Great was one of them, one of my favorite. And, of course, we didn't say it was better than any of them. We talked about it being different and the things that differentiated it, because every book has something that differentiates it or doesn't get published. But that made me think about we read many, many books, and five were the ones we did. We probably read 100, I don't know, but so many. So there's numbers of them. I could make a bibliography very, very long. But one that's from the past that had a tremendous impact on me was A Man for All Seasons, which is about the life story of Sir Thomas More, who was willing to give up his life for his beliefs, for his values, and he did that. So just to read that in the age I was and to think about that and the kind of courage and the kind of leadership and sense of responsibility and courage that showed, whether you agree with what he did or not agree with what he did, it just had a powerful impact on me and always has. And I've continued to think back on that and, you know, would I have the courage? And what do I need to do to have the courage to do what the right thing is to do? And that's a major part of our leadership model also. And another tough one. Mm. Courage to me might mean a very different thing than it does to somebody else, depending on.
Understood. So, Lynn and Bob, on behalf of our learning community, it's been a distinct pleasure to have you into our conversation today and here on Global Leader Radio. And we certainly appreciate you for accepting our invitation to join us today.
It's been great fun, a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, and we'd love to have you back on the show sometime where we can work the schedules out. Is that a deal?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Love to.
Fantastic. So with that in mind, could you tell us how our learning community can contact you by email, email address or phone or both?
Mm-hmm. Mine is just lturknet@turknet.com. And our number is 770-270-1723.
And as long as you remember the TurkNet, it's bturknet@turknet.com. So all you got to do is change the L to a B, and you've got either one of us. So that
way Bob and Lynn.
Makes it easy.
I love it. So with that response, we'll bring this edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. So we invite you to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. And also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu. I'd love to hear your recommendations for guests. And special thanks to Kathy Milsodine Martin, actually, for referring you over here today. And certainly, I've known who you were for many, many years, but certainly she had the great contact. And so those of you who are listening live and also on the podcast, we'd love to hear from you as to who you think we should be interviewing as special guests. So for those of you who are interested in our award-winning Executive MBA program, please go to the EMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio site to connect to us and sign up for an information session. So join us again at this same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with passionate people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.